Get yourself a song to sing and sing it till you're done. Yeah, sing it hard and sing it well. Send the robber barons straight to hell. The greedy thieves who came around and ate the flesh of everything they found. Whose crimes have gone unpunished now. Walk the streets, they're screaming now. They brought death to hometown. Greetings, all you 99 percenters. This is your host, Dr. Jack Rasmus, Alternative Visions. Okay, today, well, what's the big news of the week? Of course, it is the midterm elections and the sweep that Republicans have produced here, taking control of the Senate. And I would refer folks to my prediction of a month ago that this is what was going to happen. An article, U.S. Midterm Elections, Past and Present, where I predicted at least 7 of the Senate seats would pass to the Republicans, and it looks like it's probably 9. 7 for sure, and looks like Alaska, and there will be a runoff in Louisiana. And the only reason the Republican didn't win in Louisiana was because there was a third-party Libertarian running. And when they have the runoff election in early December, probably most of those votes will go to the Republicans. So the Republicans will have gained 9 or 10 seats. Amazing. And, of course, they gained even more seats in the House of Representatives. They have a huge 50, 60, well, more than 60 close to 60. Well, no, I think it's more than 60, a vote Republican margin. How did this happen is interesting. Well, we had predicted it would happen because you got to realize what this election is the continuation of the 2010 shellacking that the Democrats got, as President Obama called it, shellacking. He avoided that phrase this time. And why did that happen? Well, that's because he's simply not delivering. The Democrats simply aren't delivering for working folks in this country anymore. A lot of promises and nothing in return. And the folks that put him in, which if you look at the state-by-state turnout, constituencies, so forth, who put him in office? And again in 2012, one more chance. Who put him in office? Well, it's youth, young workers, and students. It's Hispanic voters, and it's union labor in key states where it still has some influence, Great Lakes states, and so forth. And what has happened? Well, we still have this problem with jobs. I don't care what they say about the number of jobs. Most of those jobs are part-time temp jobs, low-pay jobs. That's why wages aren't rising. In fact, the income of median families continues to fall every year. Every year since the crisis. Nothing has changed. There's no end to the crisis, economic crisis, for working folks. That still continues. When your income is declining every year, and that's probably an underestimation, 1% to 2% per year. You know, they're all talking about wage growth, the problem with wages. Yes, of course there's a problem with wages. I was watching Bloomberg News, which is, big business news last week, and there was an economist on from a hedge fund, and apparently she had done some digging into all these job numbers, and according to her, 76% of the jobs that have been created are part-time and temp jobs. In other words, low-wage jobs, no benefit jobs. Yeah, well, no wonder wages are falling when people, all they can get is wage is part-time temp jobs. And we have apparently 6 to 8 million people, her estimate was 8 million people, who just dropped out of the labor force. So what do we got? We got people coming into the labor force and people going out the labor force, out the other door. And, of course, those 8 million folks don't have any income. We got a churn going on. We don't have a recovery in jobs. We got a churning going on of high pay to low pay, permanent to part-time temp, non-union as union jobs disappear. It's a churning. I don't care what their statistics say otherwise. That's what's happening. And folks know that. And on top of that, what do we have? Well, some additional grievances. How about Hispanic Latino folks? You know that Obama's been promising to do something about immigration. Well, he deported 438,000 people last year, and which was 50,000 more than 2012, which is 30,000 more than 2011. So no wonder he isn't influencing the Hispanic vote that turned out big in hopes that he would do something and hasn't done it. Democrats just haven't done it. And so what did he do this year? He promised in the summer he was going to take executive action, and then he puts it off before the election. What a dumb strategic move. Well, obviously it was to placate some of his conservative Democrats running for office, saying, oh, don't do that, or well, I'm going to lose. Well, you lost anyway, is the answer to those blue dogs. Those are Democrats who act like Republicans, right? Strategic decisions and errors all the time going on the part of the Democrats. One wonders. The only reason they got in because everyone was totally upset with the Republicans under George W. Bush, and now people put their hopes in the Democrats and didn't get anything. Look, there's two wings of one party in this country, the Corporate Party of America. Republicans make their rich folks rich and screw up the economy, mess it up, and then the Democrats come in and make the rich even richer and don't clean it up, except for the rich, the wealthy, the investors, the speculators, the big businesses and so forth. They're doing great. In fact, they recovered immediately, within a year, and they've been doing great ever since. Look at that stock market. You know, it's at record levels. Bond markets for them, record levels. All the other derivatives market, they're making money hand over fist for 5 years. And the rest of us are 1% to 2% at best income declining. Okay, we're going to continue on this topic as we had promised, and I had communicated to you all, talking about the Labor Party once again. We had gotten up to 2007 when the Labor Party officially, the Labor Party movement officially was put to rest, shelved, except in the state of South Carolina. The AFL-CIO and labor movement had agreed to, well, let's not totally shelve it. Let's let South Carolina, where they don't have a lot of concern about other unions making a complaint about continuing. Let South Carolina continue and keep the flame of the Labor Party alive. So we're going to talk about that experience here. And my guest, I'm bringing back Mark Dudzik, who is the organizer, was one of the key organizers for that whole effort, and I hope we can get Donna DeWitt, who was the head of the Federation of AFL-CIO in South Carolina, and a Labor Party advocate as well of that, tell us what's been going on there. But, you know, gosh, there is no better time to really raise this question again. Before I have my guests join me here in discussion, though, I want the listeners, I'm going to read something for you folks. There is an organization of progressive unionists in this country called the Labor Fight Back Network, located in New Jersey. Anyone interested, just go to laborfightback.org. Or you can call them at 973-944-8975. They recently put out a statement here after the elections, which I think is worth reading because it summarizes how union labor has been screwed by the Democrats and Republicans. And it's continuing, is going to get even more screwed because now with this election, with the Republicans in charge of both houses, you watch the pro-corporate, pro-business flood that's going to occur. One of the first things, of course, is a big push on the Trans-Pacific Pipeline. In other words, free trade on steroids. And you don't think that's going to destroy jobs. You watch. It's going to make NAFTA look like a dress rehearsal. And that's going to go through now, fast. On top of that, as I've been predicting for some time, watch big corporate tax cuts. You know, Mitch McConnell, the head of the now the majority's Republicans in the Senate, made a point as soon as he got elected of saying what they were going to do. And as Mitch says, oh, gee, poor American corporations, 35% tax rate, highest in the world, not what he conveniently ignores saying to us, is that they don't pay 35%, they pay 12%. That's what their real effective rate is. And offshore, they pay 2% if they're multinationals. And as far as corporate taxes in some states, they pay 2 to 4%. They don't pay 35%. They're lying to us. You know, that's the definition of a politician, someone who's an inveterate liar. Everything they say is a lie. You can't believe anything they say anymore, what they're going to do, because they turn around, and who do they do it for? They do it for the people who pay their campaign check. And who is that? That's big business. Big business owns this two-party, two-wing of one-party system. They own these guys, lock, stock, and barrel. And we better recognize that, that there's no way forward except let's go another route. Let's create another party. That's the only way. Yes, it's not going to be easy, but that's the only way, and the time is now right. And if the leaders of the national labor movement, unions, don't want to do it, then the real folks on the ground have to do it. But I want to read to you the Labor Fightback Network statement. It's worth hearing. And go to their website if you want to find out more. Okay, here, quote, and then we're going to discuss this. Quote, Labor Fightback Network's statement of November 4th. There is no disagreement within the labor movement that we took a very big hit on November 4th elections. Labor's worst enemies among the politicians, Scott Walker in Wisconsin and John Kasich in Ohio, who led the charge against public employees' bargaining rights, registered significant victories. A large number of other Republicans across the country share their anti-labor bias. But what about the Democratic Party, supposedly the party that represents interests of workers? It was repudiated by millions of workers who either stayed home on Election Day or cast their ballots for the Republicans. In 2008, Obama was elected president, and Democrats won control of both houses of Congress. Hope was in the air. But in short order, the Democratic Party betrayed its promises to labor, without whom the Democrats could never have won the election. No legislation guaranteeing full employment was enacted. No infrastructure spending funding was approved. No labor law reform was passed. No card check, the Employee Free Choice Act, saw the light of day. No end to deportations and the breakup of families transpired. Instead, a bill on health care authored by the very conservative Heritage Foundation was pushed through Congress without even a promised public option, making the insurance companies happy, but leaving vast numbers with no health care or patently inadequate coverage. And anti-worker trade bills were relentlessly pursued. Wars and occupations in faraway countries were escalated, and more recently, Democrats joined Republicans in allowing unemployment compensation for the long-term unemployed to expire, while food stamp funding was cut a further $8.6 billion. A CBS exit poll taken on Election Day reported that 63% of Americans believe that the economic system favors the wealthy. Dissatisfaction with the status quo is very widespread and discussed with both major parties runs deep. All that is missing is leadership that only the labor movement and its community allies can provide to bring to a new party. We have to ask, what in the world is labor doing in the same party of the corporate elite? Shouldn't we be in the same independent party that is a party without the bosses, as the civil rights movement, communities of color, youth, immigrants, progressive social movements? Where do we go from here? Well, the statement concludes, there is no time to waste. The labor movement can be revitalized if we adopt our slogan, quote, The bosses have two parties. We need one of our own, unquote. And take the concrete organizational steps to bring such a new party into existence. Okay, I couldn't agree more with that statement. Overwhelming majorities, two-thirds and more, say they're discontented with the party. Majorities say they want another party. Heck, even with the young folks, majorities say they want socialism, whatever that means. The discontent is deep and wide. Look, people didn't vote against Democrats per se. They voted against incumbents. And no one really turned out to support the Democrats. You know, in midterm elections, typically only 40% vote. In national elections, 60% vote. It looks like barely 33% had voted this time. That 7% stayed home. 7% of millions and millions of people. There's probably 10 to 20 million people that did not show up because they do not believe it. Hispanics shifted their votes. Polls coming out now show that they just didn't vote or they even voted Republican. Well, who can blame them when you got a president that has deported more Hispanic folks in history than any other president? Right up to this year. Okay. I think myself that the time is ripe. Some kind of alternative is on the agenda. And we better do something about it, because if we think things were bad in the past, now that they've got two houses under their control, just watch what the Republicans are going to do. And watch Obama bend to their demands. You know, this guy has not been very aggressive in terms of principle on anything for 6 years now. He's going to do what Clinton did. They call it triangulation. In other words, pass anything, something, and then put a spin on it. Say you did something. You watch. That's what's going to happen. Oh, he may take some timid executive action on immigration, but then he will agree to a watered-down bill, if there is one, that totally negates what action he took. And watch him move on free trade. And watch him move on corporate tax cuts. You know, he's already on record since the election that he wants corporate tax cuts or tax rates reduced from 35 to 28%. That's the nominal tax rate. And he says, oh, we're going to close loopholes. Yeah, they won't close loopholes. They'll open them and cut the tax rate. This is just the beginning. It's going to be disaster from this point on, and the Democrats are going to fall right in line with the Republicans. There's nothing there for working folks anymore. This isn't the Democratic Party of your grandfathers or even your fathers. This is an animal that's been taken over by the corporate elite decades ago, and now we're seeing the result of that. And the corporate elite have deepened their everyday control of the Republican Party. They got two wings, and they're playing one against the other and still making us think that we have a say in anything. And they're screwing us right and left, and that's going to continue. Okay. I'm going to write something on analysis of this election, which will be pretty much confirming what I had predicted all along, and focusing on what's coming. What's coming, you know? They call it a wave. I call it a deluge here for working folks in this country. We ain't seen nothing yet. Okay, so having said that, I'd like to welcome my guest. Mark, are you there?
Yes, I am, Jack.
How about Donna? Did Donna make it? Oop, Donna DeWitt has not made it. Okay. Well, Mark, I guess it's you and I. I'm sure you know enough about what's happened in South Carolina labor movement. Is where we left off last time. We want to pick up and say what's happened to the Labor Party initiative that was so vibrant at one point here and had such possibilities and prospects. But for a whole variety of reasons, we already talked. If people want to pick up where we left off, go to the archive here for Alternative Visions on the Progressive Radio Network of a couple of weeks ago, when Mark and I discussed the whole origins of the labor advocates, labor party advocates, and renewal, and discussed it from the early 90s up to 2007. And we left it off where we were going to then pick up at a subsequent time and talk about where it's gone since 2011 and, you know, where it is today. And Mark, your views would be appreciated on the election here and what it means. And is this an opportunity for revitalizing the whole idea of a labor party or some kind of third party? It doesn't have to be called a labor party, but it has to be a party in which working folks and the unions and communities and students and everybody is building an alternative. We need a second party. We no longer even have a second party in this country. Mark, take it from there.
Thanks, Jack. Well, it's a wide-ranging discussion. I guess I'll start with kind of where we left off with the last interview on the Labor Party. You know, as we were discussing at the last interview in the 2000s, sort of momentum began to die for building a Labor Party. And there were a bunch of factors that went into that. The selection of George Bush as president by the Supreme Court and the sort of shifting then of the political imperatives around his policies and the discrediting of Ralph Nader, scapegoating of Ralph Nader for that event really changed a lot of the dynamics, and the series of strategic defeats that the labor movement experienced during that period of time just kind of changed the capacity to move the labor movement, the labor party effort forward. And, you know, as we've said often, you know, you can't have a party of labor without a substantial section of the labor movement there at the table, and we began to lose that by the mid-2000s. One area that, you know, we had kind of experienced sort of paradoxically a lot of support and success was the state of South Carolina, which is not a big union stronghold, but the unions there have no illusions about the two-party system. The state Democratic Party is a creature of the whole right-to-work regime in South Carolina and has been extremely disrespectful to its largest constituency, which is the African-American communities in South Carolina. And, you know, the Democratic Party, even though most of its votes came from that community, continuously refused to acknowledge their leadership and the issues that concerned those communities. So some of the leaders in the labor movement in South Carolina, particularly Donna DeWitt, who was the president of the state AFL-CIO, suggested that we may have an opportunity to launch an electoral labor party effort in South Carolina. And we thought that this might be a real good opportunity to try to continue the vision of a independent worker-based party forward during a very bleak time. We thought, you know, first of all, South Carolina is never a swing state anymore. It's been so effectively captured by sort of the right-wing Republican party that there's no conceivable scenario where you could claim that any politics that took place in South Carolina would be a spoiler for some lesser of two evil national political adventure. So, you know, that kind of argument sort of evaporates in South Carolina. And secondly, we thought that if we could show that we could build a party of labor in the heart of the right-to-work South, that it would really inspire some of the national labor leadership and organizations to reconsider our effort and think about putting some resources and organizing capacity into it. So we developed a plan in late 2006 to get the party recognized by the state as a formal electoral party. That involved filing petitions with the State Board of Elections. We in the national leadership originally were going to follow the sort of the California model, which is to hire a bunch of paid petitioners to go out, and you pay them so many cents or dollars per signature, and they go out and they collect signatures. The folks in South Carolina rejected that approach. They wanted to use the petitioning process as an organizing opportunity and go kind of one-on-one with their fellow South Carolinians and use the petitioning to talk to them about why we need a party of our own in South Carolina. So we developed a six-month organizing project where we approached mostly non-union South Carolinians because the labor movement is so small in South Carolina. But we went to places like flea markets and swap matches where working people kind of buy the basic necessities of life and kind of engaged people in one-on-one conversations. Signed up over 16,000 South Carolinians from every single county in the state of South Carolina, and got recognized in late 2007 as an electoral party in the state of South Carolina. Now, we didn't take off in the way that we thought we were going to. A couple of things happened. First, the national labor movement was in such extreme retreat and disarray that there was very little positive response to that effort, so there were really no kind of resources forthcoming to help sustain it. And then secondly, the emergence of the Obama candidacy kind of changed a lot of the dynamics in 2008 in the state of South Carolina. It was a very hopeful time, particularly for the African-American community, and it would have been really really difficult to launch an independent Labor Party campaign in the midst of the 2008 electoral context. So, you know, we tried to keep the effort alive. We ran a we needed to run a symbolic candidacy just to keep the party line, and we ran a person named Brett Bercy for a state house state legislature position, but didn't really put any efforts into it. But the folks in South Carolina have been continuing to try to keep that effort alive. And this election cycle, we ran a candidate for Congress in South Carolina District 2, which is the home of the famous Representative Joe Wilson, who's the guy who shouted "You lie" at Obama during a speech he was giving on the Affordable Care Act to the U.S. Congress.
When you say this this term, it's, in other words, they ran up a candidate here in this just election just
right.
passed?
Just this election day on Tuesday, yes.
Okay.
So we recruited a young man named Harold Gettings, Jr., who is a sheet metal worker, a member of the Sheet Metal Workers Union, and employed at the Savannah River Nuclear Reservation, which is a huge nuclear fuel processing plant, a federal reservation in upstate South Carolina. Grew up in that area, and came to his Labor Party convictions honestly as a young union worker trying to figure out the world around him, and was active in the Democratic Party for a while and got disillusioned with that. So we launched the campaign. We did not have a lot of infrastructure on the ground, but we thought that it would be a good opportunity to use the campaign as an organizing platform to begin to build something around this campaign. And Harold got 2% of the vote, got 4,100 votes with almost no budget, and kind of doing door-to-door campaigning. He built a small organization. He got universally endorsed by all of the unions in his district and by the state AFL-CIO. So we've kind of slowly begun to build a little bit out from the structures that we created in 2007. We're still there. We're still thinking strategically about where we need to go. And I think it's time to talk about how to do that in other places also.
Well, why don't you share some of your thoughts about that last statement?
It's time to do elsewhere.
What's convinced you that it may be time to do that elsewhere?
I think in a lot of ways we're at a moment very similar to where we were in the mid-1990s in terms of, the sort of disillusionment and searching for alternatives that gave rise to the Labor Party movement in the mid-1990s. You know, you have a Democratic Party that's clearly sees itself primarily as the hand servant of its corporate sponsors. And, I agree with you, Jack, that that's really the main cause of their disastrous defeat here in the midterms. There's just no reason for working people to get excited about them, except, in a place like Wisconsin, I was hopeful that we could punish people like Scott Walker. But the Democratic candidate in that election, was not articulating a working class perspective. She was trying to be, corporate light to Scott Walker's corporate heavy. So, working people can increasingly see that they have very few alternatives. Labor is facing an existential crisis in terms of the expansion of the Southern right-to-work regime, right into the industrial heartland, the use of austerity politics to attack public workers. We're being forced back to retreat into these fewer and fewer fortress states. And we're going to be picked off one by one. So we're in a huge crisis, and it's a real opportunity to talk about alternatives. On the other hand, there's not a single national union out there willing to commit the kind of resources and organizing capacity to a Labor Party-type effort similar to what five or six unions were willing to do in the 1990s. So, there's a real disconnect between what's happening on the ground and what's happening to the kind of institutions and organizations that we need to have with us. This, to me, just is a connection with the profound defeats that the labor movement as a movement has experienced in the past 15 years, in the past generation, but there's been an intensification, the project of kind of talking about independent politics, I think, is really wrapped up in this broader project of revitalizing a labor movement. And I also think that given the continued diminishment of the formal labor movement, both in numbers, geographic spread, and its ability to speak on behalf of all working people, that any party-building effort in this period has to broaden out beyond just the institutional labor movement and include other working-class institutions and organizations that don't have direct relationships anymore with the institutional labor movement. So, I think there's opportunities there. I think this is a time where we need to explore local and state level options. We need to kind of engage in discussion and debate within the labor movement. There's some interesting new national union leaders now, some of whom have historically been sympathetic to the idea of a labor party. So we're hoping that we engage in a deep debate and discussion at all levels of the labor movement, from the national right down to the rank and file.
You seem to suggest, and correct me if I'm misreading you, that the prior labor movement effort, the strategy was to rely heavily on at least the sector of the unions and the support from the unions, including all the way up to the top, which you did have at that time in the 90s. one of the fundamental elements of how to build an independent labor party. But what you're saying now is the movement, the unions have been so attacked and weakened over the intervening years that it doesn't look likely that there's going to be any similar such support from the very top leadership of some of the unions. Although I understand there might be some of the new folks coming up, like in the postal workers union, mm-hmm. that may not have that old mentality. And then you suggested that, you know, we have to rethink this strategy and rely more on other non-formal union working class organizations, perhaps, and not trying to get a half a dozen as you had top union leaders behind it, because we're not going to get that. Is that a fair representation of your more open-ended thinking now about we got to go about this differently?
I think we have to look at what we did right and wrong back in the days when we were organizing this, and how the conditions have objectively changed. So, I think that what is absolutely true is that ultimately, the sort of resources, organizing capacity that the institutional labor movement still has got to be there if we're going to have a viable working class party. I just don't see any other kind of sources for that kind of effort. So, we have to be engaged. They have to be, there has to be an understanding that they have to be at the table. But I also think that that what we do to build towards an independent working class party has to be connected with a broader project of revitalizing the labor movement, increasing both its legal capacity to represent workers and to its organizing capacity, and all of these concerns that have been marginalizing the labor movement. We can't kind of think that we can make huge advances on the political front when we're getting our butts kicked, in the workplaces and in civil society and everywhere else. So there's this kind of interaction between these two projects that really has to grow. But, I think a lot of the people now who are involved in working class initiatives are not necessarily, working in labor movement type organizations. The movement of immigrants in this country, which is, I see that as, it's a working class issue, is only has tangential connections to the organized labor movement. Yet it's a huge dynamic movement that has to be at the table in any kind of progressive alternative to the two parties of the bosses. So, this is a time to really rethink, our history and what the current situation will call for.
Well, how do we get folks in the labor movement and in the working class movement, as you say, immigrants movement? Of course, it is almost, virtually totally working class. How do we start this discussion about the new conditions and a new strategy, perhaps, or tweaking the old strategy, whatever, on getting something going? Because I don't know, I kind of feel that time is running out for us and that we don't have much time left, maybe another half or decade at the most. After that, there will be no...
After that, the Iron Heel falls.
Even as we know it, it will be so tamed and so broken. And, if it exists anywhere, it will be, totally subjugated. And we already see what's happened with the decline for the country, with the decline of the labor movement already. If it almost virtually disappears, I mean, it's scary to imagine what the options will be. How do we practically take the first step? What would you suggest is the first step here in terms of, first of all, obviously trying to understand the lessons of the destruction of the union movement so far and the lessons of the abandonment of the Labor Party. I mean, if that movement had continued, the Labor Party movement, just imagine if it had continued, and we had still five or six major unions, given the conditions today, you know, the possibilities would have been significant, I think. But as you pointed out, it sounds to me like the Democratic Party had a big role in giving the Deep Six to the Labor Party effort within the union movement. Obviously, their ranks use the Nader phenomenon of 2000. Oh, look, third parties mean, you know, George Bush comes in. And apparently, they convinced the unions that were supporting the labor movement idea or keeping it alive to turn their backs on it. And, of course, then Obama comes and they throw everybody behind. It looks to me like the Democratic Party is behind the destruction of the Labor Party effort through the leadership of the union to quash it. I don't know. Maybe I'm assuming some conspiratorial politics.
Yeah, I'm not sure it's a direct conspiracy, but, you know, I mean, I've been down here in Washington, D.C. for a few years now, and it's, you know, there's a huge section of the national labor movement that sees their job as being operatives of the Democratic Party within the labor movement rather than advocates for workers, you know, talking to the political parties about the workers' issues. And so, you know, it's gotten worse as, you know, the ability to envision an independent workers' movement has diminished so much. And, you know, and again, it's not just in politics, you know, it's the, you know, the challenge to think that we could win a large, you know, national strike against a private corporation, or, you know, we could defeat some of these right to work initiatives. There's just no sense that that can happen. So, you know, those are the kind of places that we need to be. I mean, when I'm working with the labor campaign for single-payer health care right now, because I think that the challenge and the fight to win single-payer health care really opens up the whole question of how labor does its politics. Because to win a single-payer health care system anywhere, you know, you're going to have to engage in a huge fight against the massed corporate power at the heart of the health care system. And, you know, this is the kind of engaged organizing activity that, you know, will hopefully pull together the people who really want to fight within the labor movement and within the broader working class. And, you know, we can take those lessons and move them forward. You know, I think that there's got to be space made for us to begin to debate and discuss these issues within a broad audience of activists and leaders within the labor movement. That was one of our great successes when we were building the Labor Party, as we were, you know, a number of regional labor-based organizations and institutions, you know, were holding these forums and discussions and debates, and we brought together people and, you know, sat down and, you know, face-to-face talked through a lot of these issues and concerns. You know, we have to find some dynamics where we can do that, and we have to challenge the national labor movement to move some of its resources into these open-ended, longer-term organizing projects and initiatives, you know, rather than, you know, constantly circling the wagons around the next election. You know, if you put 10% of, you know, the money that they just wasted, you know, in these midterm elections defending corporate Democrats who were bound to lose, if you put 10% of that into a proactive project to organize discussion, debate about, you know, new initiatives and new ways to organize, bringing people together, you know, we'd begin to rebuild a movement that could speak on behalf of all workers.
Well, I absolutely agree with you that there has to be a serious discussion at the grassroots within the union movement and within these other organizations about which way forward. I mean, if it's not working, why do we continue doing it? You know, it meaning supporting Democratic candidates. It's just not working. And we're getting nothing out of it, as that Labor Fightback Network statement, summarized so nicely. Everywhere, you give hundreds of millions of dollars every election, unions do, to get Democrats in. And what do? When they get in and they had a majority, they had a filibuster-proof majority the first 2 years, and they didn't bring any labor issues up to speak of. And Obama had no jobs program, still has no jobs program. You know, he puts the head of General Electric in charge mm-hmm. of the jobs program. Well, what do you expect? Jobs program becomes free trade, which is not, that's a jobs destruction program. And housing, what did Obama do for folks, working class folks, in foreclosure and everything? Nothing. He turned it over to the state attorney generals, and then when the attorney generals went after the banks and mortgage companies and had a deal, because they caught them red-handed, the banks throwing people out of their houses and evicting them, what did Obama do? He jumps in, takes control of it from the state attorney generals, throw some money at them at the state level to keep them quiet, and the whole thing gets wrapped up and put away. And then we got the student debt, trillion over trillion dollars. It's all government debt. They could expunge that tomorrow and have no effect on financial markets. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's just paper. It's just government. Owe it to the government. It wouldn't upset any businesses or anything. But nothing, absolutely nothing forthcoming. And I think we need to discuss these things, but, I think we need to jump out and do some pilot projects, because there's nothing like people saying, oh, it can be done. The vast majority of people don't even come out and vote anymore. Certainly working folks don't vote anymore. The majority of them don't vote anymore because they feel there's nothing there to vote for. And I think, and I had suggested to the Labor Fightback Network over a year ago, I said, why don't, instead of talking about this and debating this, why don't you do some research, find a couple really potential districts, House of Representatives vote, potential districts where you have a large student constituency, where you have a large Latino-Hispanic constituency, where you have still some union constituency, and do your research and run somebody in these very high potential two or three, four across the country and get some wins, And then people will look around and say, hey, it's possible. What people need more than anything else is an organizational place to turn to that they think is theirs. That's the big question today. There's no place for people to turn to. The Democratic Party is not a place anymore, and other organizations are not a place. They need somewhere, and I think if there were a place, you would see a flood of people supporting that. But someone has to jump out there and do it.
Yeah, well, we looked at that strategy, Jack, and the problem is that most of the districts that you describe are already represented by fairly progressive pro-labor Democrat types, and it makes it much harder to go in there and, and do the break. I mean, it's much harder to break with.
I wouldn't target those, Mark. I would not target those.
So you
got to
find this unique thing where you have, a huge, already existing constituency of students, immigrants, African Americans, union members, but in a political situation where they're not represented by one of these folks who, some of the left wing of the Democratic Party, we would expect, if we ever launched a viable labor-based party, they would join us.
I'm sure there would be.
The dynamic.
The caucus there, they're probably tearing their hair out, the Democratic Party. But there's nowhere else for them to go.
Also have to say on the negative for that type of folk that they tend to keep, they're part of the problem often. They keep people hopeful that change is possible within the Democratic Party. And, you know, it's again, it's hard to condemn people like John Conyers, you know, who've been out there fighting for a lot of working class issues for a lot of years. But, you know, regardless, you know, to think that we can do that through the Democratic Party creates some illusions. So.
Well, what I mean is also identify districts that swing back and forth mm-hmm. between Republican and Democrat. In other words, those are the districts, I think, that are vulnerable. Now, there's not a lot of them left because they gerrymandered themselves, yeah. both parties, into safe positions, right? That's why the Democrats will never take over the House of Representatives in the foreseeable future. They sold themselves to a Faustian deal here not too long ago where they agreed with Republicans to safely gerrymander each other's districts. You know, they looked at their own careers, let's protect myself, not what was good for folks in their own constituencies, safe constituencies. And notwithstanding that, I still believe that there are places where you have these constituencies, but it is a swing vote. You know, sometimes it goes Republican, sometimes it goes Democrat, that kind of a thing.
Mm-hmm.
And I think if you could find districts like that with as well, you know, to some extent, the constituencies that are discontented, you might be able to some very targeted campaigns. And I think those who advocate, you know, independent politics, working class politics, Labor Party, whatever you want to call it, should take this next step, not just talk about it, but take the next step and try to see what can be done. You know, there's nothing like success to get people moving. But you, if you're just talking, I don't think that you know, folks are going to get all excited about more talk. I mean, they know the problem. Most working folks know the problem that both parties aren't their party anymore. And all the polls are showing it now, you know, 63%, 58%, 67%, right?
Mm-hmm.
They don't want the two parties anymore. And they, you know, majority, would you vote for a third party? A majority says yes in many, many places. I mean, it's ripe. But no one is taking the next step. And I agree with you. I don't think the national union leadership is going to get behind this and take the next step. So another direction has to be found. I believe and have been saying that as the crisis of organized unionism grows deeper and deeper, and it will now, watch this right-to-work thing really come up with a vengeance. Now that the two right-to-workers, Kasich and Walker, you know, survived, others are going to say, hey, we can do this and survive. And so this right-to-work offensive is going to spread even more, and even greater attacks on public workers are going to happen. But, you know, I think if folks could see an alternative effort, the organization question is before us here, and we either rise to it or we continue going down the same slippery slope. And as I was saying, I don't think that the top union leadership, as the union movement gets weaker, I think what you're going to see is them grow even closer to the Democratic Party out of desperation. We already see this happening, and that's a road to oblivion, I believe.
Yeah,
so
but,
we need to find another strategy.
You see some bright spots here and there, Jack. I mean, you know, the Chicago teachers have been really trying to push for a working class challenge to Rahm Emanuel in that election. You know, Karen Lewis got ill in the middle of her the campaign, and you know, it's kind of lost some steam. But you know, that remains to be a very hopeful project. The Seattle election of Sawant to the city council, you know, is a breakthrough. The Lorain, Ohio, there's a labor-based candidates that took on the Democratic machine and took over the city council in Lorain, Ohio, a year and a half ago. 2 years ago, I guess now. So there's, you know, there's some hopeful signs. In New York, the Green Party candidate ran on basically a working class agenda. A guy named Howie Hawkins, teamster out of UPS in Syracuse, New York, you know, got 5% of the vote in a statewide campaign. Got more votes than the so-called Working Families Party, which had endorsed Andrew Cuomo for governor.
So, yeah, well, you know, those are the things I think are great signs. I agree with you.
Richmond, California. You know, they just took on Chevron in Richmond, California, and beat them. That's, you know, they showed how you can beat big money. And I think, I don't know all the details. I know some of the folks in Richmond, but I think a lot of that had to do with real on-the-ground organizing to counter the big money that went in there. That people were there. They had been in those communities a long time, and they were able to counter the What did Chevron spend? Something like $3 million, and the other side spent $60,000. So,
yeah, for a mayor's race and a
few councils. Yeah, for a mayor's race.
Yeah, it shows you that money you can't win all the time if people really get organized and get behind it. But, you know, you're making my case here. I absolutely agree with you. There are great lights, you know, in the darkness out there, and but that's what we got to think about, a new strategy. How do you build a new strategy around that? That's my only point.
And I will say, by the way, that like in Chicago, the American Federation of Teachers, the national union, which is not known for its political independence, said that they would contribute $100,000 to Karen Lewis's campaign if she were to run for mayor in Chicago. You know, so again, there was some ability to move the institutional labor movement based on, you know, real facts on the ground.
Oh, I have no doubt that if there were a real grassroots local union and local community movement with, you know, going out independently and attempting to do these political campaigns, that you know, some of the top union leaders would come behind it eventually, but you can't expect them to come behind it now, and they're not going to come behind it now, and they're going to oppose it now, but only when it becomes a real movement with some successes at the grassroots will they come behind it. So I think that's a possibility, sure, but the next step to me is, how do we get some courageous local union people who aren't going to be bought off even by their own national union, and courageous community organizations and immigrant organizations into the same room in these vulnerable districts, into the same room and say, okay, we're going to do this. We're going to do independent politics. And we're going to put something people power behind this, like in, you know, Seattle and like in Richmond and places, Lorain, places like that. And I think it's going to catch fire if someone would take that next step, you know. And it's going to take leaders, local union leaders and local community leaders that are courageous enough, that are willing to extend beyond their comfortable little, you know, area where they are influential, and to venture out into risky waters for the sake of all working folks. You know, you have to put your career objectives on the line, and you have to take that next step. I mean, we're going to have to find people who are courageous like that. But just talking about it isn't going to do it, I don't think. We got to, at this stage, engage in some experimental efforts with courageous local people. And the strategy then differs from the 90s, when you had people at the top who were willing to get behind it. They're not willing to get behind it now. So the strategy has to be different. It has to be from the bottom up, and it has to really be with the grassroots folks, and it has to be not just unions, it has to be other organizations that are really working class. I agree, the immigrants movement is a good example of that, and others. But, you know, even in immigrants movement, you've got a lot of different organizations and groups, and, you know, leaders of these little organizations feel comfortable in these little organizations sometimes, not all of them, but sometimes, and they'd rather be, big shots in a small pond than, part of a bigger movement in a greater lake.
You have those problems. And, look, the other problem you have when you deal with NGO-type organizations is the corrupting power of foundation money and other grant money. That's, again, one of the reasons why we stress kind of organic working-class organizations like unions, because they are one of the few institutions that don't depend on those type of structures for funding, either corporate money or corporate money laundered through various foundations and other funding agencies. So, we've found, for example, it's almost impossible to get foundations to fund fights for real health care reform for single payer. And when you look at who funded the foundations, you're looking at companies like Johnson & Johnson and Kaiser Permanente. So, there you go.
Yeah, and even some so-called left publications take all kinds of foundation money and left radio stations and so forth. So absolutely, that's a big problem. But that's how they control, meaning corporate America, control these possible challenges before they even develop. Yeah. What do you think is the next step? What should be the next immediately one or two steps in your view?
Well, I think we've got to fight around issues. When we raise issues, we win. The referenda on the minimum wage increases and paid sick days and things almost universally succeeded. So we've got to build organizations around issues that push the envelope, and we've got to find ways to organize that kind of discussion and debate within the broader working class movement about, building towards the future. This is a time when we've got to, challenge people to, think about where we need to be in 5 years and begin to move the resources there. So I think those are two places that we could really begin effectively. Organize around issues on the ground and choose the kind of issues that really push the envelope for working people, and build debate and structure it in a way that, we can really build an organization and a strategy coming out of it.
But that doesn't sound to me like anything different than we've been doing. Pushing for minimum wage and living wages and so on and so forth. It doesn't suggest that, let's rethink this strategy that did not work in the past to build the Labor Party, independent Labor Party, for whatever legitimate reasons. So what's the new strategy for building a Labor Party, and how can we initiate something organizationally? Again, the organization.
Jack, I think that only emerges from a real dialogue with real people. I'm really reluctant. I really find distasteful the sort of efforts that various leftists occasionally initiate, where they kind of develop the perfect analysis and the perfect policy among themselves and then expect everybody to buy into it.
I absolutely agree with you. Absolutely.
You and I and five of our friends could construct the perfect program for the American working class, but we would maybe appeal to another 10 of our friends to come on. We need to bring people, figure out who needs to be at the table from the beginning in these discussions. Make sure that they're there and that their concerns are voiced, and then we begin to hammer this stuff out.
I agree with you, Mark, 100% on that. It's got to come from below, and it can't come from intellectuals top-down or organizations creating it abstractly. So we agree on that, and I guess we'll have to end on that. And next week we'll talk more about the elections.